The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Welcome to this free episode of Dunked On. If you're interested in the NBA salary cap, I highly recommend subscribing to Dunked On Prime. In addition to Nate and Danny's 5 episodes per week that often get into cap issues, you'll also get my daily dunks, which are exclusively on Dunked On Prime. I often go into salary cap details. Today it was digging into what the Suns could do with Chris Paul, who has a partial guarantee for next season. Are they allowed to waive him, waive and stretch him, re-sign him, under what circumstances? How could it be financially advantageous to both sides? Dug into that, and that's just one example. Stuff like that several times per week. You'll also get Seth Partnow's written analysis. You'll get a Hollinger and Duncan episode every week, all ad-free. So we hope you'll take advantage of our mock off-season sale. Named, of course, after the mock off-season, where Nate, Danny, and Kevin Pelton and myself will each split up the teams. Nate will be the agents. We'll negotiate contracts beforehand. It's another great way to learn more about the NBA salary cap, the NBA landscape, what options are available to teams, what routes they might pursue. It's proven to be highly predictive over the years. We find it a valuable exercise for really assessing the market. And this is a great time to subscribe so you can get that episode and everything else we're doing. You can subscribe with that mock off-season sale at dunkedon.supportingcast.fm. That's dunkedon.supportingcast.fm.
All right, welcome on to the return of the Cap Father, Larry Kuhn, kind enough to join us again. We hit on many of the major points in our first episode, but that, of course, is nowhere near good enough for us. Now we got to really get into the weeds, the minutiae. We've both had a chance to have some conversations, clarify a few things as well, and really get into basically everything that we know about this upcoming 2023 CBA. Larry, before we get started, I know part of why you wanted to come on is to talk again about Sports Business Classroom. We'll save some more time for that at the end if you're interested. But quickly, what is the new deal that y'all are offering?
Well, thanks, Nate. And yeah, this is twice in one off season that I'm on Dunked On, which is, you know, I'm first of all, I'm honored because I haven't seen you that much recently. So it's good to be on the show. And yeah, Sports Business Classroom is going to be July 9th through 15th, immersed. I mean, we are in the arena, immersed in the NBA Summer League in Las Vegas, Nevada. So we are nearing selling out, and I'm just trying to get the registration closed so I can pay attention to things like, you know, rewriting my entire curriculum because there's a new CBA, you know, little trivial things like that. So let's just get registration closed. I'm going to incentivize people even more. So you got to listen to this podcast, first of all. And in fact, I might do something to make sure you're going to listen and not just do, you know, your usual cap space promo code, but we might throw a twist at people because I want to catch, I not only want to get it closed, but I want good students. We're always looking for the best people. And Dunked On has always been one of the prime places that the people who are right in our demographic will congregate. Your listeners have always been great in becoming SBC students and moving on from there. So I want to incentivize that. So stay tuned toward the end of this podcast, and I will give a special offer.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, it's good to know that we have the absolute biggest nerds listening to this program. That's what I've always taken pride in. So we hit on most of the big stuff back in mid-May. If you want to catch up, listen to that one first. The place I want to start actually really quickly here, to just bandy back and forth, is the term. We have another 7-year term for this. But again, it's this mutual opt-out after 6 years, and it ends. So that would be the summer of 2029. One or both parties may send written notice of opting out a little bit earlier now. It's in October. I think it was in December the last two times. This mutual opt-out, why do you think they do it that way with this mutual opt-out?
Yeah, it's easy. And this is a, you know, proven way to get stuff done. You know, I'm a manager in my day job. I'm a manager. I have many people working for me. And there's lots of assignments going on at any one time, projects, et cetera. If you do not set deadlines, you don't know when things are going to get done. You have to set deadlines, and that's going to give people something to work toward and make sure that things are getting done when they're supposed to be getting done, so that you have time to sequence other things that have to happen that may be dependent on this thing. So it's just this big set of setting the correct deadlines for the work and making sure people meet those so that the whole thing flows. Now, if you think about the CBA, if they go right up to the expiration date of the CBA, that's not a good thing, because the next day, lockout, right? There is no CBA. They can't open the doors and do business. They have to lock out the players until they get a CBA. They get the ground rules down for them to open the doors and start doing business again. You can't let it go all the way to the end. Of course, sometimes that happens. It happens in 99. It happened in 2011. It even, you know, happened, one of those things, it happened for a couple of days in 2005, the situation I just talked about, where they basically had an agreement in place, but they went all the way to July 1st, and they had to say, okay, everybody freeze, we got to continue working on this. And they had an agreement within a few days, and, you know, then had to ratify it and then go through the drafting of it and getting that signed off, which takes time, and it wastes time for the league, because yeah, the offseason is all summer, but it's also short in many regards. So the best way to get this done so that they have a new agreement in place in time is to set an earlier deadline. And the mutual opt-out allows them to do that. They never really intended for this to be a seven-year agreement. They intended really to be a six-year agreement, and which is what happened this past time and happened the time before that. They intended to be a shorter agreement where the stakes are a little bit lower, right? The worst thing that's going to happen, they don't have an agreement. They just play that last season, that seventh season of the CBA, and they get into the 2005 situation. Hopefully they get it done in time. They're probably scrambling at the end. And by the way, the more they're scrambling at the end, the more errors creep up and, you know, things that they don't think about.
Yeah.
They'd rather get this done ahead of time. Setting a deadline a year ahead of time in the form of a mutual opt-out is the mechanism that does that.
Yeah, and the moving it back from December to October, I think that's been, they've experienced some of that this year where they pushed it back and then they pushed it back again, the deadline to opt out. So there never actually was an official opt out that occurred this year, right? That it was,
right.
So, and I think the mutuality aspect of it, that's, I've always been like, oh, what's the point of that, right? Like, somebody's going to opt out, somebody's going to be unhappy. And when it comes to player contracts, you know, they don't really have that in basketball. Like, Josh Hart kind of has that this year, but it's really hard to establish it due to some of the rules. But I think that it is kind of useful to have that, just because each side is always sort of trying to win the PR battle. And so if there is a labor stoppage, the other side can say, well, hey, we were ready to just play out the year. Like, they're the ones who opted out. So there is at least a little bit of an aspect of forcing sides to the table. There is a negative to be like, all right, we are the ones who officially hit the button to blow this up and potentially lead to a work stoppage.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the last time that negotiations were really not on friendly and productive terms was 2011. And since then, the working relationship between the league and the union has been really good. So, you know, hopefully it stays that way and new deals get done a year ahead of time and everybody's happy. But should it ever come down to another situation where, and, you know, it could be different players in the room, it could be different situations on the ground, whatever. If they ever get into a situation where it's not on such good faith and friendly terms anymore, then the mutual opt-out gives both sides that weapon. So neither one is wielding that over the other two.
All right. A few other things we need to hit on here. I'll let you take the next pick of whether it's in conversations you've had or something we didn't get to the first time, something that you find interesting or maybe uninteresting, and we just have to talk about it anyway, because that's what we do here. Sure. What do you want to get to here?
I'll just go to the first thing on my notes with my last conversation, which was just this is a minor point about cap smoothing. And I may have even made this point when we talked last, but just to clarify here, because we were talking about how the cap, they finally got cap smoothing in the agreement, which they should have had in the 2017 agreement, but they just failed to get it done. The league proposed it. There were people on the union side who were in favor of it, but the union overall came down on the side of, no, we're not going to accept that proposal. And that was to the detriment of a lot of players because...
Yeah. The league didn't want to give them anything, and the union didn't understand how it was going to help them to do it. And so you just ended up with it not getting done, and they both hurt themselves in the end, probably.
Yeah, when you're in the mode of doing transactional negotiation, that's an issue where you're looking for something in return for something. It's like, no, this is not something we're getting. This is actually, we're proposing this for your good, because the without cap smoothing, when there was a huge spike to the cap, what we call the shock to the system, right? When that happens, under the old system, the money could only go to the free agent class that year. And, you know, a huge jump to the cap, teams need to spend at least 90% of the cap. So teams need to really increase their spending. Players already under contract, they're already under contract. So they're not getting any more money. At the time, under the previous CBA, all of these, or two CBAs ago, a lot of the exceptions, the rookie scale and the minimums were set in advance. So they were trailing the market by the time you get toward where the new TV deal came up. And the money could not go to rookies coming in, could not go to minimum salary players, could not go to players on exceptions. Who does that leave? The free agent class. So we get to the situation where, you know, I always joke that Timofey Mozgov and Lou Alding, you know, really cashed in on that one, because, you know, they got the money had to go to these players, and they got enormous deals well above their value, not only in terms. And then because it was a seller's market at that point, they got 4-year deals, which is the maximum. And those were just bad contracts that really hamstrung those teams. Under the new agreement, and oh, by the way, the cap smoothing concept just artificially keeps the salary cap lower than what the formula would say. And the formula is supposed to set it appropriately based on the money that's supposed to be coming in. By artificially holding it lower, it's forcing the league to pay the players collectively less than they're guaranteed to make. And when that happens, the CBA says, that's a guarantee. You got to pay us that money anyways. So the league writes a check to the Players Association. If they're, whatever, $500 million short, they write a $500 million check to the Players Association. The Players Association distributes that how they want, but their practice has always been to distribute it to all the players in the league. So what cap smoothing does, in effect, through that mechanism, is says if there's a big shock to the system, then the money goes, the extra money goes to all the players in the league and not just Timofey Mozgov and Lou Alding and whoever happens to be a free agent.
Right. Don't give Bismack Biyombo short shrift.
And Bismack Biyombo.
He's actually like probably of all the players that got crazy contracts that year, it's either probably him or Batum that are still that are even like still playing at this
point. I know.
Yeah. Someday I'll have to go back and do like a full accounting of which of those deals ended up the craziest. But yeah, so I think it's a really good thing. I was thinking like, well, some players are going to try to time their free agency for the summer of 2025 when the new TV deal kicks in. And now that you're limited to a 10% increase in the cap, I mean, that matters. That'll give some teams cap space, but you're not going to have, that'll be phased in over a period of years when that new TV deal. So you won't have just that 2025 free agent class benefiting.
Yeah, so if if there's a huge spike in 2025, so two things. The first thing is, like we said, it's cap smoothing. They say the cap cannot rise more than 10% year over year. So if a huge influx of money comes in from the new TV deal, the cap otherwise would have risen 30%. Well, it's only going to rise 10% in that first year. The excess money would go to the players league-wide, which smooths that shock. It spreads out the money. And then over the years, they catch up. The players still get collectively what they're guaranteed to get. It's just the money gets spread differently, and because this money goes through a different mechanism. But then the second thing is they already fixed a lot of the problem anyways. Because like I said, under two CBAs ago, the 2015 CBA, they had preset minimum salaries, the rookie scale contract, and exceptions for the entire length of the agreement when they signed the agreement. They just factored in normal, increases over the life of the agreement. And so they said, these are what these values are going to be for the exceptions and the minimums and the rookie salaries for this year, next year, all the way through 7 years from now, so that you could not give them more money, 6 years later when there was a huge cap increase. Those exceptions in proportion to the salary cap were just way behind, way below what they should have been. Well, they fixed that. So in the new agreement, in fact, they made it even better in the new agreement. Now, everything is tied to the cap year by year. Rookie scale salaries, minimum salaries, even like the apron margins and things like that. Everything in the league.
The tax bans, that's a big one too. Yeah.
Right. Everything in the league goes up or down in proportion to how much the cap goes up and down. So if the cap, even without the smoothing, if the cap increases 30%, well, every exception, the rookie scale contracts and the minimums also would increase 30%. So at least more of the money can go to those people. But then with cap smoothing, so that's now becomes the secondary form of controlling the shock to the system. The cap smoothing just ensures that it gets spread out even more. And now we have a system that's just much more palatable. There's no incentive to become a free agent in a particular summer. And the league likes that. The league likes a situation where it doesn't matter which season you happen to become a free agent. It should be all the same. And you could time the length of your contract for other reasons than, oh, I want to be in this season when this thing happens financially.
All right. Good explanation there of the cap smoothing. And if only you'd been around to explain that to Michelle Roberts in 2014, maybe something that could have been avoided.
I was there and I was saying
we were all saying it. Was not listening at the to time. Me. But I mean, that was in their defense. That was a different climate. There wasn't as much trust between the sides. True. And again, if the league had really wanted it that much, they could have offered something to make it happen.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
So we can transition here. We talked about this a little bit on the last program. I wanted to clarify it because I think it's just become clear as a result of conversations that we've had. We talked about this idea. This is kind of a small thing, but I wanted to make sure we clarified it since we weren't quite right on it last time. The idea of a team being over the second apron and then sign and trading a player. You can think of this ultimately as the Kevin Durant, D'Angelo Russell rule, like another one of these bill of attainder style of changes so the Golden State Warriors, the Clippers did something. So now we're going to take it away. So you recall in the 2019 offseason, Kevin Durant leaves and the Warriors do a sign and trade with him and get back D'Angelo Russell. And you can either, they got a trade exception. They happened to use it at that time. You could also have, they could also have just saved it to use it later. Now, however, you can't do that anymore. If you are over the second apron, or if you sign and trade a player and get a traded player exception, then you can't go over the second apron later. That essentially you can't do that anymore. You now, If you sign and trade a player out, that's not a mechanism to get a trade player exception, keep your salary up, and bring another player in anymore. You just don't get that traded player exception. And so that's basically just a way. It's kind of funny because now that incentivizes even more. The only way you can keep your salary up is just re-signing your own free agents. You can't do it by that traded player exception. So what do you think of that briefly? Is that, I don't think it's going to matter too much, but it's basically a way to say like, hey, if this guy leaves, you can't keep your salary up anymore.
Yeah, so the first thing here is noting that whenever Kevin Durant changes teams as a free agent, they have to make a new rule, period. All right, yeah, the second thing.
That's right.
You know, the whole point of the second apron, or, you know, the hold my beer apron, is that they were trying to come up with more and more onerous ways to disincentivize the teams that just didn't care about how much they were spending. You know, the Warriors being the prime example, but, you know, the Clippers, you know, any team that just says apron schmapron, we'll keep spending. They had to further disincentivize that. And I even brought it up, like the whole thing we talked about in the last podcast, where we were talking about the freezing of the draft picks and the effect there. And I was just kind of going back to, you were just looking for new and creative ways to mess with teams, weren't you? Well, we had to come up with something. So, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, how do you further penalize a team that where we want to start imposing further penalties? And, you know, the freezing draft picks was one, and all these other things we talked about in relation to the second apron. And this thing that you just brought up being another one where, okay, you under the first apron, under the previous CBA, you couldn't receive a player in a sign and trade. Okay, that penalty is still there, established at the first one. Now, at the second apron, they're saying, okay, not that you can't sign and trade a player, but as you said, they lose the exception that you would gain for having signed and traded a player. So it makes sense as something they take away. Now, when we were looking at it previously and sort of reading what they wrote about it, it was a little bit unclear what they meant. So I'm glad I got that clarified.
And this is, as I mentioned, one of these reactions to something that a team did. But it's amusing to me that in this CBA, we have a few mechanisms that eliminate the unintended consequences of these previous rules that they came up with. We already talked about eliminating the designated player limitation last year. And then the other one of those is they have now relaxed what I like to call the Carmelo rule, where after he, before the 2011 CBA, wanted to be traded to the Knicks and then sign an extension for basically the full amount of money he could have gotten as a free agent, they prevented you from doing that. After that, it was if you extend, you either can't be traded, so there's a limitation on it. Basically, previously, you could, if you extended for more than 2 years or greater than 105% raises, and that's two extra years, so three total, including the current season, then you couldn't be traded for 6 months. They basically wanted to, or if you've been traded, then you can't sign an extension for more than that for 6 months afterwards. They basically wanted to prevent players from doing that. And of course, what ended up happening was that was the idea behind that was, oh, well, then players won't ask for a trade. But players
There's rules against, you know, they put limitations on sign and trade and extend and trade as a single transaction. So they have to cover the bases when the teams try to get around this by doing it as two separate and distinct transactions, by saying, you know, they can't say, well, if you sign this, you can never be traded. So they have to come up with a point in time during which you can't. And then after that, it's fine. 6 months is what they come up.
And so now, though, they've relaxed that Melo rule. And so now you can, that limitation is 4 years extension. So basically 3 new years if you're in the last year of your deal, because that 4 years includes any remaining seasons on the contract. And now you can get up to 120% raises. So you can't get your full amount, because that would be 5 years and 140% if you're not subject to that limitation. But it's been removed a lot. Basically, I think because they realized, oh, wait a minute, this thing that's supposed to protect teams, like, oh yeah, players just, well, if they can't get their full money, they'll be happy there once you prevent them from going somewhere else and getting it. No, of course, they're still going to want to be traded. Or probably more importantly, teams themselves are going to want to move guys when it doesn't make sense to retain them. And hey, if the team that's receiving the guy can extend him and have that security of knowing, hey, I just traded for this guy, now I can offer him a contract that he's going to agree to, that benefits everyone, right? Rather than quote unquote protecting the team that's trying to trade the guy, it actually hurt them because they couldn't get as much for the guy in trade. And same thing, of course, with that designated player rule where, you know, the Anthony Davis can't get traded to Boston, who has the best package because Kyrie Irving is already there. That only hurt the New Orleans Pelicans probably in the end, who's trying to trade him. So they kind of figured out, like, oh, wait a minute, like, this is completely counterproductive. It only hurts the teams we're trying to protect, so let's loosen these rules up.
Yeah, this is kind of a greater theme that certainly was continued in this CBA, but even existed in the last CBA, where you have your spenders, your overspenders, and your egregious overspenders, right? And they were focused on overspenders, period, in form of the luxury tax, in the form of the system restrictions, and even the cap rules that existed prior to that, where there were a lot of, you can't do X because X gave them an inch of advantage in gaming the system. And they had to go in and try to prevent all the possible ways of gaming the system, with the unintended consequence, as you said, where sometimes that prevents things that make sense from happening as well. So in the last CBA and the new CBA, and especially the new CBA, they're saying, okay, we understand that everybody is a spender. A lot of you are overspenders. We're not going to care about that as much. It's the egregious overspenders that we're really going to focus on here. And for everybody else, we're just going to go back to relaxing the rules because, yeah, you can get away with an inch. You're not going to get away with a mile by doing that. And this is all going to even out at the end. So why not relax the rules? And we see this in relaxing how exceptions can be used. We see it relaxing the trade margins, how much you can get back in trade. A lot of these other things are, it's like, let's just relax the rules, let more stuff happen, let the chips fall where they may. It's all going to work out evenly. And we're going to focus on more on the overspenders and disincentivizing them through the tax and the other things at the first apron, and really put the hammer down on the egregious overspenders. So
the underspenders for that matter too, right? That was the other thing, yeah. Right? I think that to me is not being talked about it enough. I mean, at some point, we'll want to get your opinion on just like kind of who won these CBA negotiations, because I think there's a feeling that the players just got hosed, and I'm not sure that that's true. But that's maybe once we get through everything, we can talk more about that. Just so we have it here, you referenced it. We didn't specifically do these numbers. So in terms of relaxing the trade margins, now, if up to $7.5 million in outgoing salary, you can bring back 200% of that plus $250,000. So you could trade out a guy making $7.5 million, bring back a guy making over $15 million if you wanted to do that. Of course, this is if you're below that first apron. So it's just much easier to add salary there. And then between $7.5 million and $1 to $29 million, then you can take back plus $7.5 million of whatever you're sending out. And then once you get above $29 million in outgoing salary, you're limited to 125% of that plus $250,000. So you've got just more flexibility to add salary, make trades as well. So just wanted to get those numbers out there for people who hadn't seen or calculated that yet. What else we got to talk about here? What is on your mind? Could be small, could be big.
Well, and just one more piece of commentary. Okay. What you just said. Yeah. So this is a perfect example of what we were just talking about, right? It used to be that, you can go and trade up 25% plus $100,000 fudge factor. They increased it in the last CBA to 175% plus the same fudge factor. for low salary trades. Again, look at thinking here. If it's a low value trade, we don't care so much about you exceeding a certain margin. You're fine, right? It's only when you start spending a little bit more, it gets into that middle tier, and it used to be 5 million. You can go up, and now it just increased to 7.5 million. And it was only the high value trades that they really reined them in, because that's where teams can really cause some damage. And they just loosened it up. They loosened it up to 200%. They loosened up the fudge factor for everybody to $250,000. So it's a perfect example of the small stuff. We're not going to sweat. We're going to try and make it easier. So back to your question, was what are some of the other things to talk about? Well, I did get some clarification on a couple of things. Let's sort of talk about the comp, because we did say that, since players are required to attend the combine now, that gives the league access to all the medicals for players, which is a good thing for teams who are thinking about drafting a player, to be able to have more complete information to look at when they're making these crucial decisions. And the league sort of protected them a little bit, where if you're the likely first pick in the draft, then the medicals only go to certain teams in the range where, like, 1 to 6 or 1 to 9, something like that, where the player could likely be drafted. If it's like the first one of the first three picks, it can go to like the first 15 teams. If it's the rest, then it can go to the entire league, something like that, where a team just can't get the medicals on a player who might be drafted well above where they're going to draft, because you have no reason for that. So the first thing that I thought of, and I think we talked about this in the last podcast, was, well, what about a team who is thinking about trading up in the draft? Do they get screwed? Because, the team that they're trading with has these medicals in hand, and the team who's thinking of trading for that pick does not. Can this pick, this team that is looking at trading the draft pick, go, I see this in the medicals for this player. I don't think we're going to trade this pick. I think we're going to trade this pick, not use this pick, because we're worried about this medical condition for this player. So sure, we'll trade the pick to you. Let's do this negotiation. And then the other team gets the draft rights to the higher pick. Now they're entitled to the medicals, and they read the medicals and go, oh, geez, I didn't know about that when we were doing this negotiation. So that point was acknowledged with a big but, which is, teams don't, by and large, almost exclusively, do not trade draft rights before the draft, right? They would typically trade either at the draft, depending on when on a certain pick that's made, and also if it's before the draft, you're not restricted to a particular player. Okay? If you trade up to, let's say, the third pick, you've got the third pick, whether the guy that you're looking for has a potential medical issue or not, and you still get to select from all but two players in that draft at that third pick. So you're not hugely disadvantaged by the fact that the medicals on the guy that you were looking at aren't what you were hoping to see.
Yeah. And of course, you can also just ask the guy's agent to give it to you. There's nothing restricting them from giving it to, generally, if you're going to trade up, like, you, for example, Markel Fultz, the Celtics, trading away that pick to Philly in 2017, if that was done ahead of time, they knew who they were going to get. Fultz was okay with going there. He wanted to be the number one pick. Like, usually if it's going to be that high in the draft, guys will want to be picked there. So usually you can work it out, even if for some reason they're outside of that range of teams that's supposed to get the medical information.
Yeah.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
And then I have one other clarification to give real quick. Sure. Where we were looking at the language and weren't entirely sure about how they're implementing this. And this one was as we were thinking it should be. And this is the case where if you're over the second apron, any trade exceptions from the previous year expire. And of course, they have to complicate this. For the purpose of this rule, a year starts and ends the day after the team's season ends. So either somewhere from April to June, where they can start making trades again. And we were wondering, okay, what exactly, you know, because you're talking about a non-simultaneous trade, a quote-unquote trade exception, where you trade one guy for less money, whatever the difference is, you have that as a gift card to cash in for the next year. And we were wondering, well, okay, so a team is over the second apron. They make a trade at the trade deadline in February. Does that mean, you know, if their season ends May 15th, that on May 16th, that trade exception vanishes? And the answer is yes, that's exactly what it is. So when their season ends, any trade exceptions that arose previous to that day, basically, they don't get to use them anymore. Just one more disincentive when a team is over that second apron.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess the idea being that, again, same thing, to just lower your salary artificially. And I think part of the reason for that is, okay, let's say you're at the second apron at the trade deadline, you trade someone away, get a trade exception, you get under the second apron, right? Like, there's an incentive to do that, to unfreeze your draft pick, etc. And then, oh, but you still have the trade exception from having been over the second apron earlier in the season. And now the next season, you can just get right back up to that salary level again. And then, oh, okay, maybe somebody that we signed isn't performing, we'll just do the same thing again next year. So it kind of prevents you from doing that dance of artificially getting out of the second apron, even though you're starting off over it every year. And so it just makes it easier to get back up over the second apron again at the start of the year. So they wanted to prevent that. That would be my read on that.
Yeah, and teams also remember parlay those trade exceptions over successive years by just doing more trades into the exceptions. They get a little bit smaller each time you do it. But teams have successfully been able to do that quite a bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's probably more of a Clippers centric bill of attainder there. So we talked a little bit about the combine, and this has been something that's gotten a lot of press as well. This is something that the league was really pushing for a long time. Agents pushed back on it. If you didn't want to go to, say, back when they weren't any good, the Sacramento Kings, for example, you did not send them the medicals. Now, basically, players have to attend the combine. They have to do to the extent that they are physically able, the strength and agility tests, shooting drills, and all of the anthropometric measurements, I think is what it says here. 5-on-5 still optional though at the combine, and there's other stuff, doing the media when you're at the combine as well. That's kind of been a big focus of the CBA, is just getting the players to do more media stuff, even when you're not playing in games, for example, during the season. And of course, the most important stuff, that medical. And if you don't do that, then you are basically not eligible to be drafted.
Yeah. And even if you have an excuse for injury or whatever, when you're able to do them, you still have to do them.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's an objective standard of players not being able to participate. They're required to complete what they can do. And then they have to subsequently complete those components at a later point. And generally, it'll be hard to fudge that, because, I mean, unless you're just the number one pick, obviously, and you're injured, you can't just go do a private workout for a team later. You have an incentive to work out. And then if you do that, it's like, oh, wait a minute, but you didn't do the testing. It's like, well, all right, come over here. Let's do that testing.
Right. So you're saying that Wemby is trying to get out of going to Dallas? Is this a scoop? I'm sorry, San Antonio, not Dallas.
Yeah, San Antonio. So no, I mean, by all accounts, he wants to go there. And there are a few other things too, because there are going to be findings by these physicians And maybe the player doesn't agree with that, right? Maybe the official is like, all right, this guy's knee is messed up. You can now get an independent second opinion from a physician at the combine. And that will also then be entered into the player's file. So you have, if you disagree with one of these medical findings, this is like the official thing that every team is going to see. So you could say, no, here, let's get a second opinion. Right. That goes into that file as well.
And by and large, anything that's a judgment call like that, whether an incentive is likely or unlikely, whether, any little thing like that, where it's a matter of interpretation, it goes, there's a means to appeal that to a third party. There's the fitness to play panels and the ability to appeal those. There's, the independent basketball expert for likely versus unlikely incentives, things like that.
So this is another interesting one. And there are actually a lot of complaints about this. John and I were talking about this a little bit, of players or agents organizing their own pro days. This is something that's happened. You're not going to be able to do that anymore, basically. They're just going to be a couple of them that are organized by the NBA and the Players Association in certain areas, in addition, of course, to having everyone have to be at the combine. So you're not going to have this thing where every agency has their own pro day. Everybody's got to fly there. If you want to do something like that, it's got to be at kind of one of these league sanctioned approved pro days, or it's just going to, again, be individual workouts with teams.
Yeah. And the whole thing with that, with the medicals, is just, they don't want draftees playing favorites. They want every team to have an equal opportunity as defined by the draft for any player. And they don't want any player able to dictate which team he's going to go to or strongly influence that decision.
And then also for the draft, I thought this was important, that you're not automatically eligible now if you play in a domestic pro league. Basically, if you're playing for G League Ignite and you want to stay there another year, you are not automatically eligible. It used to be if you play in a domestic pro league that isn't the NBA, you automatically become eligible for the draft. But now that they have G League Ignite, that doesn't make sense anymore. So they're eliminating that. There's no reason for guys playing professionally. I think Overtime Elite would be another one of these too. Playing professionally for a U.S. team to be in a worse situation than guys playing professionally overseas. So they eliminated that rule. They treat them the same, basically.
Yeah, the distinction between what's a professional basketball player has sort of been demurred over time, and this just recognizes that.
All right, what else do you want to talk about here?
One other little thing I have, which is, and this is something I complain about to anyone who will listen, including you, I have never liked one of the restricted free agency rules. And that rule is the one that if a player is a restricted free agent, he can receive an offer sheet during the July moratorium, which is great, because it fixes one of the problems, or it attempts to fix one of the problems, which is by the time teams turn their attention to the restricted free agents, a lot of the money's dried up because it's already, the big money has been allocated to the players who are unrestricted free agents. And, by then you only have a few teams with any kind of spendable cap room left. And teams don't want to freeze their money for a long period of time because they can't exercise plan B or plan C or whatever. So restricted free agents just become the afterthought in this whole process. And the unrestricted free agents are the kings. And so they made a good move in the last CBA, I thought, which was to say a restricted free agent can receive an offer sheet during the moratorium. But they didn't start the 2-day matching period, which under the current CBA is as short as 1 day. They didn't start the matching period until after the July moratorium ended. So the net effect is that, let's say that a restricted free agent got an offer sheet on July 1st. Well, the other team didn't have to match it until July 8th. 2 days after the moratorium. So rather than giving the other team 2 days, put them under pressure, you got to make a decision in 2 days, otherwise he's ours. Now you're giving the team 8 days to make this decision. And, that's even worse on the restricted free agent. So the response to that was sort of a, yeah, but again, where part of it is they wanted to have the team who was under that pressure have the opportunity to do some kind of maneuvering that they have to do, making another trade or freeing up salary or whatever, in order to be able to keep their own guy. And the teams can't do a lot of that kind of maneuvering during the moratorium. So they wanted to provide that a window of time for that opportunity after the moratorium, which makes sense.
And they wanted to just make it harder to do an offer sheet and keep restricted free agent salaries down.
Yeah. And the other part about that is because they made the point, yeah, you're still, I mean, and I even said, how many restricted free agents in the past CBA received an offer sheet during the moratorium?
And the answer is zero, right?
That's the answer. So, you know, clearly this rule allowing a player and a team to sign an offer sheet during the moratorium didn't accomplish anything. And because the disincentive is stronger. And it just came down to, yeah, you know what? Restricted free agency is just that. It's restricted. And there are things you can't do as a restricted free agent. And this is just one of those consequences. And in striking the balance between the players and the league, we and the teams, we made it better, right? We shortened the match period. So it got a little bit shorter. And that does help the players, but it didn't entirely tilt the balance in favor of the players. We're continuing to try to strike that balance between the players and the teams.
Yeah, not much to add there. I wanted to add this one, and this one hasn't been talked about very much that I've seen. You now have more flexible stretch rules. I call this the Joakim Noah rule, where in the summer of 2018, the Knicks had this big plan. They were going to use cap space in the summer of 2019, but they didn't want to have Joakim Noah on their roster for the entire season, taking up a roster spot. They wanted to waive him, but if they waived him and didn't stretch him at that point, then his whole salary for the 19-20 season would have been on their books, and they wouldn't have had the amount of cap space. So they basically had to decide in the summer of 2018, do we stretch him or not? And so they ended up stretching him, his remaining salary over 5 years. That gave him a bunch of cap space. They didn't get the Kevin Durant, who they wanted. They ended up getting Julius Randle, which actually worked out great for them. But they still, it seemed like they may have, if they'd had their druthers, they would have rather let Noah's salary be on their books for the full amount and then just had more flexibility going forward. Now, though, you can stretch a guy and, or you can waive a guy and you can make a one-time election by August 31st of any salary cap year to stretch that player. So in this case, the Knicks would have waived him, left all of his salary on the books for the 18-19 season when they weren't going to do anything with cap space anyway, gotten that, whatever it was, $18 million out of the way. And then if they had wanted to, if they really had free agents they wanted to sign, they could have elected to stretch that one remaining year on his contract then over 3 years. It's also will help out guys like John Wall. You remember, he kind of just wallowed on the Rockets for a couple of years because they're like, ah, you know, we could still maybe trade him. Like, we don't know if we're going to want to stretch him or not, when we're going to want to use cap space. So it'll enable guys to get waived when the team doesn't want them anymore and allow the teams the flexibility. I really like that rule a lot personally.
Yeah. And another team that utilized that was the Lakers when, you know, we're back to talking about Luol Deng again.
Yeah.
They did waive Luol Deng, they waived him at the specific time where, you know, after August 31st, because, you know, that date still existed under the old rule, where they waived him after August 31st, and then that upcoming season wasn't waived. So his full, you know, $2 billion or whatever salary was under the Lakers, you know, didn't get stretched. And that meant that the stretch in the subsequent years, that the amount that was stretched was much lower in every year. That gave the Lakers more cap room. So they just accelerated the stretch for Luol Deng effectively to give them more cap room the following year. So they just rely again, let's not sweat the big stuff. I mean, the small stuff. They just relaxed the stretch rule. And another thing that they did was stretch. And to be clear, there's actually two kinds of stretch. You stretch the actual money that you pay the player. So that's stretching for cash purposes. And you also could elect to stretch the cap hit, you know, stretching for cap purposes. So a player's salary was always automatically stretched for the purposes of, for cash purposes, the money you're actually paying the player. but the team got to elect whether to stretch for cap purposes. They might want to be completely off the salary in another year and not stretch it over 3 years, for example. So teams can elect to do that. And again, loosening it a little bit. So they did two things to loosen it. One, there was a $250,000 minimum. So anything below $250,000 was peanuts. We're not going to stretch that. It's too small a stretch. That limit's increased to $500,000. So now if it's $500,000 or below, then it's peanuts. We're not going to bother stretching that. But they also, instead of increasing that $250,000 limit to $500,000 for both kinds of stretch, they only did it for cash purposes. For cap purposes, they eliminated that $250,000 minimum. So you're all now under the new rules, to summarize, for paying the player his actual paychecks. He gets it all according to schedule if it's $500,000 still owed or below, and it gets stretched if it's $500,000, if it's above $500,000. And then for the cap hit, the team can elect to stretch any amount. So they can stretch $1 into $3, hypothetically. And so you can have a situation, by the way, where a player is stretched for cap purposes, but not stretched at all for cash purposes, which couldn't exist in the previous agreement.
Yeah. Well, Demetrius Jackson still on the Celtics books for one more year at $92,857. You could see some pretty small amounts stretched.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This is one that, again, hasn't been talked about that much. I think it's interesting. I think I like it, but I wanted to get your thought on it. So previous to this, there's this implied no trade clause that basically if you would lose your bird rights by getting traded, let's say the most typical example is someone who signs the qualifying offer as a restricted free agent, right? So they're on a one-year deal. At the conclusion of that deal, they've already been on the team 4 years before that. And so they would have bird rights at the end of that deal. However, if they got traded on that one-year deal, they would not have the bird rights with their new team. And therefore, they would lose that. And so that's why there was a no trade clause, because they wouldn't have a way to get paid with their new team in theory. And now you're in a situation where the team and player can agree to waive that at the time of signing the new 1 year contract. So you can say, hey, you know what? Like, we'll pay you more money now, but you have to agree to waive this implied no trade at the time of signing, so you don't have leverage over us later. It's basically the team, in theory, paying the player more to have the right to trade him, even in this situation. And of course, the two parties would agree on that, and the player presumably would be incentivized in some fashion to do that. And also, because he's making more money, then maybe he would have still that 120% bird rights, and the new destination would be enough. What do you think of that rule?
I like it. And this is another case of them trying to fix things because of unintended consequences. So the reason the rule exists in the first place, where a player under a one-year contract who would have bird rights at the end of that year, his bird rights would drop from full bird to non-bird, because they don't want that kind of, stepping up the basis with one team in order for just to set up a trade to another team where that team gets to take advantage of the bird rights that accrued by that previous team. Under longer deals, that's fine. That's the usual situation of bird rights are traded with the player. But a one-year contract, there was ways to, kind of game this. One of the ways to game the system. And they ended up saying, well, we're going to prevent that happening by saying you don't get full bird rights. You have to have enough tenure with that team now to regain those bird rights. You can't just, under a one-year contract, you can't gain those bird rights just by virtue of a trade from a team that signed you to a one-year contract. There's too many ways around that. Unintended consequences, it disincentivized a lot of contracts that teams and players would want to sign, because teams would say, I don't want to sign a player with who's going to have a no trade clause hanging over me. I don't want to lose the flexibility I have to move players when I want to. I don't want the players having the control to say, no, I don't want that. There are negotiated no trade clauses in the system, but that's a conscious decision that happens with like superstars, and that's fine.
Yeah. You got the 4 and 8 limitation there too. So
exactly.
It's very, yeah, and exactly. You have to become a free agent. You can't get an extension. So there's a lot of limitations. Only a player as good as Bradley Beal deserves it.
Exactly. Yeah. So the team makes a conscious decision in that case that, you know, separate and apart from any other decision, and adding a no trade clause when you qualify is an extra decision you can enter into and not enter into. But if you sign one of your players under this circumstance to a 1-year deal, that no trade clause kind of came as part of the package. You couldn't separate it out. And that disincentivized teams and players from signing those kind of 1-year contracts. And, you know, which prevented some signings that teams otherwise would have wanted to make. So now they're separating those two things, just like a no trade clause with the superstar, a negotiated one, is a separate transaction from the rest of the contract. Now, the no trade clause, it can be a separate transaction where when you negotiate the contract, you also have the opportunity to negotiate whether that no trade clause stays in or goes out. So if a team wants to have the flexibility to tell the player, we're not going to sign this under those circumstances because we don't want you holding this over us, they don't have to sign that kind of agreement. But otherwise, if the team and the player agree, here's more flexibility where we can get a contract done that we're both going to be happy with.
Yeah, and we'll see. I think a lot of players just aren't going to have the leverage in that situation. And so they'll just end up having maybe not getting more money, but also having to potentially give away their bird rights. But in situations where the players do have the leverage, then maybe they would actually get paid a little bit more. A couple of really small things we can hit here. I don't think we need to analyze them, but I want to just be thorough. I actually think there's a good thing. A player who's dismissed and disqualified under the anti-drug program, we've seen that happen to Tyreek Evans, OJ Mayo in recent years. Now they're eligible to apply for reinstatement in 12 months rather than 24 months. I think that's good. Like the NBA had this really stringent anti-drug policy going back to the 80s when these were considered major problems. And you know, I think we've come to a different understanding of situations like that. And so they don't have to take them back. This is just when you're eligible to apply for reinstatement. They can still say you're not allowed back in, but to at least make that 12 months instead of 24, I think that's still plenty punitive and also allows for more rehabilitation.
These are young guys, and young guys often make mistakes, and you know, they have maturing to do in many cases, and this allows for that possibility. So I'm all in favor of that. Yeah, as you said, they don't have to take them back, but they can if the situation warrants.
And then there's another small one here. Profanity is now allowed in interviews.
Thank God.
Find guys for that anymore.
Well, another one that I saw, again, one we don't have to analyze, the whole leaving the bench 1-game suspension if there's an altercation on the court, right? Well, okay, so something happens, players jump up and take a step into the court, 1-game suspension automatically, even if they think better about it. It was just in that one split second that they were like, what?
Yeah.
And now they take into account, okay, how far did you go out of the court? You know, what did you enter this whole thing? They're allowed to have that kind of discretion when deciding whether to penalize the player.
Oh, let me tell you, man, David Stern would never stand for this. It's got to be a bright line rule. Okay, so we have two things left that we probably need to hit on here. I'll let you pick which one we're going to talk about first.
The first one.
We have the games played requirement for generally recognized league honors, and we have changes to the two-way contracts. Which one do you want?
All right, let's get the sillier one out of the way first.
That would be the games played requirements.
Yeah, exactly. Well, first of all, what the heck is that doing in the CBA in the first place? I mean, come on. Yeah,
well, It has to be in there because you need to know what the criteria are for that, because it affects how much guys can get paid. Like, if you're going to have these criteria and you also have these league honors leading to guys getting paid more, then you have to put it in the CBA, right?
Yeah, which is its own problem, you know, and of itself. But, you know, and that said, this is another one of those cases where a rule is put in to fix a problem in a way that doesn't really fix the problem, right? They're trying to minimize rest days by incentivizing the players to play and not take rest days. The players aren't the ones deciding, I want a mental health, I want a vacation day today. I want to go shopping with my kid. Yeah, you know, these are team decisions to rest players for strategic purposes and to make sure the player lasts the season. And to tie that, the two together, I think you're not addressing what the problem is.
So let's go through what these are anyway. My feeling on this just generally is that I think it's dumb. I think that voters already consider games played and minutes played, although there's now a specific instruction to voters that they must consider the aggregate, including both minutes played and games played. Like, that never occurred to me. That's important. but then again, I guess I'm not a voter. Maybe some do need that.
You scored 40 points a game. You played two games.
Yeah. Now, to me, and this is to be eligible for, you got to play basically 65 games. There's a few things that are caveats to that we don't need to get into. So this is to be eligible for MVP, All-NBA, Defensive Player of the Year, All-Defensive Team, or Most Improved. So a few exempted things. Interestingly, Rookie of the Year is exempted from that. And All-Rookie, of course, if you had these requirements for All-Rookie, you probably wouldn't even get 10 qualifying rookies some years.
And that's true. That's part of the reason, right?
Right. Well, because a game only counts if you play 20 minutes in it. Essentially, you get like three games that you can play less than 20 minutes in. Yeah. So, whatever it is. I don't care. It's so dumb. But
it's already too much, you know.
Yeah. But it was so interesting to me, and I think this is part of it, that these are one of the things that got the most pub early on in the negotiation process, that this is going to be there. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the NBA is trying to negotiate their new TV deal in the next year, and that this is just basically, see, we're doing something about this. We're not going to tolerate this. Like, our regular season product is better. It's probably not going to be, ultimately. And there aren't that many players where making All-NBA is going to matter for how much money they're making. You might see guys in the fourth year of their rookie scale contract who are in like their seventh or eighth year trying to make designated player veteran extension eligibility where it might make a difference for them. Other than that, I don't necessarily think that it will. And I guess the only other thing we can talk about here is it's now everything's positionless now with All-NBA and All-Defensive Team. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, it's I think it's a good thing. And I think we mentioned this last time, right? The three of the top players in the league are fives, which is a situation that usually didn't exist before, you know, and before, when it was, you know, all the positions, you know, five was separate from four and three in these things. You know, you get a couple of good centers and one's going to be second team and, you know, one's going to be third team. So now the situation that we have, you know, where we have Jokic and Embiid, you know, and, you know, other good players, it lets the best players be on the first team, which, again, if incentives and things are tied to that, then it kind of makes sense.
I like it for all NBA because the league is about stars. It's about having those one or two guys on your team. Like, that's what truly drives winning. So I like that aspect of it. I like the idea of the 15 best players being on that list, so you don't get a few of these guys who are, you know, just not that good, frankly. That's happened a lot at the forward position lately. Yeah. That offsets the 65 games played requirement at least a little bit to me, because you still will be able to reach deeper into positions if you need to. I don't really like it for all defense, though, because the voters may just pick guards anyway because they don't understand like who the most valuable defensive players are. It's just so hard for a guard to be one of the top 10 most valuable defensive players in the league. So it's really going to skew towards centers and bigs, maybe a few wings. And that, I don't like that as much. I want the best guards to be recognized. And this isn't going to do, like, I think, because you have to really build a full team defensively. So yeah. I do think that, like, if you're a guard, you should be recognized. Even, yes, we realize that you're not as valuable, but I still want to know
some of the best wing defenders could be guys who just don't play all that the regular minutes. They're more situational players.
Well, yeah, I kind of like that a little bit though too, because I like Matisse Thybulle making it. I never really cared for that because to me he didn't play enough to be that valuable. He wasn't closing games. His offense was so bad that he was playing like 21 minutes a game. So I actually don't mind that aspect of it. I like it that it's you there. I would put the requirement lower, but in terms sure. of yeah, if it's just a pure defensive specialist who doesn't play that much, it's hard to be that valuable to me. But
We're not talking about that valuable. Period. We're talking about that valuable as a defender if we're talking about all defense. So,
But if you only play 20 minutes a game and another guy plays 35, it's hard to be that valuable. If you can't be on the floor at the end of the most important times of the game, then how valuable can you be as a defender?
Good discussion over a beer. Well, and then the other thing.
We're not drinking beers right now.
It's a work day for me. Yeah, and the other thing about this whole rule, you know, it's not this that they put the rule in, but now you have to add all the ancillary rules to cover all the nuances, right? Well, what if it's an extraordinary circumstance where the guy played, you know, just under, but he really should be considered? Well, what if it's a situation where it's a pandemic and the league doesn't play 82 games? Do we still want to keep it at 65? You know, well, but what if, well, but what if, well, but what if? And then the CBA is 1,000 pages long.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Okay, let's talk about the two-way contracts. What are the changes going to be to two-way contracts? A few of these have kind of already been phased in as a result of the pandemic, but just comparing it to the 2017 CBA, what do we got there?
Yeah, and you're right. A lot of this is just saying they made changes because of the pandemic and said, you know, this makes a lot more sense to do it this way. So one of the nice things, there's now three two-way players per team instead of just two, which is good, right? It's clearly a system that works. Why not expand on that? Instead of a player having a very small salary when he's playing under the G League and an NBA salary, you know, prorated by day for when he's with the NBA team, it's just 50% of the rookie minimum salary. So it just makes it easier.
Yeah. And that had already been implemented, but it was that the whole service time, how many days is he actually with the team? Did he practice that day? Was he flying somewhere? Like that was all so miserable. Now it's just, there's a limitation on the number of games he can play, and he has a flat salary.
Exactly. It's 50 game limit on the active list for games during the regular season, you know, which is prorated down if the player signed partway through the season. They did put in some protection for one of the problems. And the problem was teams that opted to sign a two-way player rather than the 15th guy on the roster. Carry 14 regular NBA players on the roster and fill in the rest with two-way players. Agents of these players are saying, you know, our players are getting screwed. We should be in that 15th roster spot. Only the team doesn't want to do the 15th roster spot because they got to pay more. Well, now, if the team has fewer than 15 players on, you know, regular NBA contracts, then they call that a quote unquote under 15 game. And then a team can't have two-way players on their active list for more than 90 of these under 15 games during the regular season period. So it makes it so you can't just do two two-way players and not sign the 15th player, just carry that for the season. You've got to have a regular guy in there. Otherwise, you're going to run out of those quote unquote under 15 games and you're going to have to do it anyways.
Yeah, that was something that came up with the Warriors this year because they only had 14 roster spots. Another change that they've made to accommodate that third two-way spot is that now you have 21 off-season roster spots rather than 20. Mm-hmm. So you're not disadvantaged there.
Well, it's just another good thing. Again, it's more opportunity for players to be seen in camp and get that kind of exposure, that kind of opportunity.
And then also the signing deadline has been moved back. It used to be January 15th was the deadline to sign a two-way contract. Now that's been moved all the way back to March 3rd. I think that's a good thing as well. It just give a little bit more flexibility there. And just to close it out, international player payments. This is something that doesn't get a ton of reporting or anything, but teams can pay. I forget what the number is in this first year. It's like around $1 million, I think, that you can pay basically directly to an international player's team to release him from his contract, basically pay his buyout for him. If you do that, you now have to bring the guy over essentially for a real contract. You can't do that and then bring the guy over for a two-way. The idea is essentially, hey, if you're going to do this, utilize this mechanism. He's got to be important enough to merit a real NBA contract. Is the thinking.
Which makes complete sense.
And then if this third two-way spot, if it does lead to the league doing what you were talking about and only signing 14 players to real contracts over and over again, if the NBA basically averages fewer than 14.5 full roster spots per team in two consecutive years, the Players Association can say, all right, this isn't working. We're going to eliminate this third two-way spot and go back to the way it was. They have that,
right,
that ability. And then also, this is nice as well, that you can pay a guy up to $75,000, waive him, and then get him in the G League. It used to be $50,000. So that's just a good way to like get more guys into the system. Like $75,000, that's like an actual living for a year. $50,000, you know, it's getting a little closer to not being that. So, and it's
gonna go up. $50,000 was the maximum guarantee for a G League player, and they upped that guarantee to $75,000. So that's why that incentive to go to the G League and play for your team was up.
Now, and then, so I would say you think it's a like unequivocally a good thing to have a third two-way?
I think with the protection that teams can't just use those in lieu of having that 15th roster spot. I mean, unequivocally, that's
sorry. I never should have used such a draconian word when I'm talking to you. I know you would never agree to that. You overall think it's a good thing. Is that?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now that you soften the language there. Yeah. Again, it is a development contract. It provides, well, first of all, it provides for more jobs for more players at a better salary. Now we're, you know, half the NBA rookie salary. It provides more development opportunities, and teams are finding players in the G League and developing them, and they're becoming strong, productive NBA players. You know, Alex Caruso is an example of that, and there are many more.
Yeah, to me, I'm kind of torn on it, because I think it elevates and gives more opportunities for guys who aren't that good and allows them to get paid. Now, if you're basically talking about 18 guys per team, but I think it also limits what guys who are really good and outperform those two-way contracts could do. They're kind of stuck on a two-way, whereas before, if you were the best player in the G League, nobody would sign you. Then you would just sign an actual NBA contract and be on that NBA contract. And so for teams that don't have suffer a bunch of injuries during the season or something like that, it can, to me, lead to a lowered quality of play, because if you need to sign new guys, there just isn't anyone out there anymore. That's already been the case. And so I think throughout the league, it probably leads to a lower overall quality of play, because if a team just needs to sign guys with an injury exception or something like that, who has to play, like, that guy's just going to be awful. Now, some of those teams want that guy to be awful at the end of the year.
I think that's a good point. More players are spoken for in a league where there are three-way contracts. That's a very good point.
Now you can also argue, though, hey, every team already has three guys who are talented. You should be able to identify guys who are good, and they've been in your system all year, so you should be able to bring them in. You've already
got that guy. There's no reason to go shop the market.
Yeah. So, but some teams will do a bad job with their two ways,
Teams switch two ways during the season already, anyway. So.
Yeah,
we can see a lot of shuffling like that too. And then in terms of, yeah, there are situations where a good G League player, by not being on a 10-day contract, I mean on a two-way contract, would, you know, could become a free agent and then sign a regular deal the next year. Yes, there will be exceptions, but by and large, in the aggregate, you know, is the net benefit a positive, even though there are individual exceptions? And I think it's a yes.
The one thing I really wish they would have changed that they didn't is the qualifying offer for guys coming off of two ways. That's miserable. It's basically just another two way in a lot of situations. And that's, to me, if you're going to hold a guy restricted, like, you need to offer him at least a real NBA contract at that point to, like, hold on to a guy's rights.
Was there a qualifying offer change on that? I can't remember.
What? Let me see. I don't recall seeing it. I was looking for it and I didn't find it.
We're requiring 15 days on active or inactive list eliminated.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So anyone is now required. I think that was just like basically two-way guys who didn't play at all in the NBA. You could just keep them without having to actually give them a qualifying offer as a restricted free agent. So now that seems like a relatively ancillary change.
Exactly.
So yeah, I don't love that. All right. But one thing I do love is sports business classroom, whereas you like to say you are immersed in the summer league. You are so deep in the summer league that you can't even see the surface. You're going to forget about your real life for a week. You're going to forget about your family, your friends, everything. You're just going to be immersed in basketball at Sports Business Classroom, the NBA Summer League.
You're going to be so deep, you're going to be looking up to see the court. Yeah, so Sports Business Classroom is going to be July 9th through 15th at the NBA Summer League at the Thomas & Mack Arena in Las Vegas, Nevada. If you've ever been to Summer League, you know that the entire league is there. You know, and if you're looking at the business of basketball and you want to be around, you know, front office people who are in the kinds of jobs that you want to be in, or you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, the superstar players aren't playing, but you know, you're seeing Wembanyama this year. You're seeing all sorts of great rookies and young players this year. But if you're interested in the business of basketball, this may not occur anywhere else in sports. I can't think of any other example where the entire organization, the entire league, is there in one building for an extended length of time in a relaxed environment. So if you're looking to network with people, if you're looking to, you know, pick people's brains, if you're looking to make those sorts of connections and the kinds of learning experiences, there's no other place to be that's better than being at the NBA Summer League. And Sports Business Classroom, like I said, we're right in the arena because we are part and parcel of Summer League. So it means that we can bring everybody from the league. You know, I've grabbed everybody from Adam Silver all the way down to, you know, scouts and analytics people, say, hey, come talk to our class, and we will have people come in because they're right there. And we're also doing the opposite. We're taking it the converse. We're taking you and putting you out into the arena. We have assignments for you, scouting assignments, other things like that you're doing. You can scout games with NBA scouts and pick their brain about what they're doing and see what they're looking for and noting. You can have your own work sort of critiqued. You get great academics. One of the things I say that if you're looking for a job in the league, I like the people who are not just a specialist in one thing. You know, yeah, there are salary cap specialists and there are scouts who specialize in scouting, but it's the people who have a broad breadth of knowledge, who can connect the dots. Those kinds of people have value, and it's all about providing value. So I'm going to give you an education in everything, the cap, scouting, analytics, you know, even media and broadcast, because people flip around so much between the two. And also, you need to know how to deal with media and broadcast people if you're going to be in a front office job. We're giving you work assignments. We're elevating your breadth of knowledge, putting your feet to the fire in certain circumstances where you're almost playing with live ammo in doing some of these assignments. Because we are right there making it as realistic as possible. So I don't think there's any better opportunity in sports. If you're looking to get immersed in the NBA, looking for one of those jobs in the NBA, between SBC and the Summer League interns who, you know, also are in that situation. Yeah, I think the count now is like 200 people who have gotten jobs in the league. I just heard yesterday about one more of our alumni from last year who's now working for a team. So, you know, people are coming to the Sports Business Classroom to get that education, to do that kind of work to build their network. It's not who you know, it's who knows you. They're coming to the sports business classroom to get all that, and they're getting it. And the success ratio is really, really high. So I'm really proud of the program. Nate, you and I developed it together, where I think there was like one weekend in San Francisco where we just locked ourselves up and hammered out a bunch of stuff. And then right before the program, that first year, you pulled an all-nighter and hammered out a lot of the rest of it. And the bones of that are still there. We've grown it every year, made it better every year. And I think its results and its reputation speaks for itself. So again, July 9th through 16th at the NBA Summer League in Las Vegas. Go to sportsbusinessclassroom.com to register. But like I said, Nate, I have a lot of jobs at this point of the year, especially in a CBA year, where not only am I doing my usual thing of coordinating everything to develop the program and getting everybody registered and dealing, you know, with the incoming students and all the work that goes with that. This year, I've got to revamp a whole lot of stuff because there's a new CBA. So all my CBA content is stale at this point, and I've got to spend some serious time with that. So I would love to get registration just closed off by June 15th. That's my goal. So all that leads up to say, okay, if you are interested in joining, since you're a Dunktown listener, since you've listened to this podcast, and because I'm going to use a different code for this, if you use Nate's regular CapSpace code, I'm going to give you $300 off like I always do. But if you use the code, I don't know what should be used. I'm just going to say June 15. If you use the code June 15, I'm going to up it to $500 off. But you have to use it by June 15th, hence the code. Easy to remember. If you are a Dunktown listener, you use the code June 15. By June 15th, I'm going to give you $500 off because I want to get this baby put to bed.
All right. And the one thing I'll add to is you're just going to have a great time. It's going to be amazing. Like you are going to meet a ton of people that really love sports. If you're the person who loves basketball the most in your friend group, and you've never been able to find people who share that passion, like this is the place to do that. And whether you're trying to get a job in the league, whether you just absolutely love basketball and want to see what's out there for you, I highly recommend doing this, of course. And again, that code is June 15th. So thanks everyone for listening. Larry, thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you all next time.
In addition to taking advantage of that promo code for Sports Business Classroom, again, this is a great time to subscribe to Dunktown Prime with our mock off-season sale. You can subscribe at dunkdon.supportingcast.fm. That's dunkdon.supportingcast.fm.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.